Welcome to the 2017 Bay Area Book Festival. This is Sherilyn Parsons, founder and director of the festival. Enjoy the conversation.
Welcome to Feminist Activism Through Popular Fiction. If you were looking for the Cannabis Now program, that's outside. I am Claire Light. I am your moderator today, and I was supposed to plug my books, but I didn't bring them. I knew I wasn't going to. However, I have an urban fantasy book coming out as soon as I find a publisher called Monkey Around, so keep an eye out for that.
Yeah.
So I'd like to thank all of our non-existent sponsors, and I was going to introduce our speakers, but I think it would be much better if they introduced themselves. So I'm going to ask all of you to tell us your names, your latest book, or all of your books. Actually, give us all of your books, and tell us what genre you think you're writing in, perhaps what genre the world thinks you're writing in, and what your biggest frustration with that genre is, and you can take it in whatever order you like.
Okay. We had a lot of mic problems yesterday at our other panel, but you can all hear. Okay, good. I'm Saray Walker, and I wrote Diet Land, which is my own book.
Thank you.
And I did work on Our Bodies Ourselves, the 2005 editions. I did contribute to that. But this is my only book so far. As for genre, that's kind of a tricky question, because when I was writing Dietland, I thought I was writing literary fiction. You know, accessible and reader-friendly, but literary fiction. And then when it was published, it was considered popular fiction. So one of the things, I think since my book was first published 2 years ago, is that I don't really know what these genres mean anymore. And I think they're mostly for marketing purposes for the most part. I think that if I had to pick a genre, I think feminist fiction is what I would call. That's kind of an umbrella term that includes so many different other types of books under it. But I think that that's the most fitting, so that's what I'm going with.
I'm Kate Raphael, and really happy to be here with these illustrious writers. Murder Under the Bridge, I write mysteries about, so far I write mysteries about Palestine, although I have ambitions of writing mysteries about other things. Murder Under the Bridge was my first completed and published mystery. Came out in... In 2015, it is, I go around saying, and nobody's contradicted me yet, that it's the first English language mystery with a Palestinian policewoman as a protagonist. And the second in the series, Murder Under the Fig Tree, will be out in September.
All right.
So my name is Meg Ellison. I write science fiction, I'm pretty sure. Very specifically, I write post-apocalyptic science fiction where women are people. This is my first book. It's called The Book of the Unnamed Midwife. It won the Philip K. Dick Award in 2014. Thank you. The sequel, The Book of Etta, came out from 47 North just this year in February. And I guess the biggest frustration I have with my specific genre, being post-apocalyptic sci-fi, is that the books are written by men and for men, and the women in them have perfect eyebrows and shaved armpits, and they don't menstruate, and they have sex on command.
My name is Aya De Leon. And the genre that I think I'm writing is feminist heist. It does not appear anywhere on any list of genres. So I am officially, according to my publisher and others, writing urban women's fiction. And I also, because it fits all the criteria, I'm also writing romance. But I don't particularly think of the books that way. And I think the biggest frustration that I have with genre in some ways is, so, but without getting into all of it, I'm really grateful to be writing for Kensington Dafina, because their main demographic is young, Black and Latina, poor and working class women. So a lot of times people of color get our books published and it's, you know, if they're published by big five publishers, they end up getting a really white audience because a lot of those publishers don't really have channels to reach working class and poor people of color. So I'm grateful for that. At the same time, a lot of the imagery that sells those books is not always what the feminist and social justice audience is looking for. So these are my covers. My first book, Uptown Thief, came out last year and just won an independent publisher award. Yay. Very exciting. And the new book, The Boss, came out this past Tuesday and is for sale here. And what I want to say about these covers is they're not, you know, I write about sex workers who are heisting corrupt corporate CEOs. So it's not like these are that these women or women who look like this don't appear anywhere in the book. They're a little thin compared to the women in the book, but they do appear. But the challenge is that for feminist and social justice audiences, when they look at this, they don't think that's a book about radical wealth redistribution and feminist healthcare. And so that's just been one of the challenges, figuring out how do I reach out to audiences that are going to look at that and make a set of assumptions that don't reflect the book.
All right. Okay, so let's get a little abstract for a second, but I want you all to bring in examples from your own work and also from other work that that you can call out. There seem to be two ways to address structural inequalities in fiction. The first being you reiterate those structural inequalities, you represent them, and then you show your characters fighting against them. And the other one is you imagine a world or a corner of this world in which those structures don't exist or aren't relevant. So the first risks re-inscribing those structures in your audience's mind. And the second one risks brushing off these alternatives as fantasy worlds or utopias. So what is your take on this? And do you have other solutions in mind? And please, everyone feel free to answer all of these questions, but if somebody else gives your answer, you don't have to answer. You can just ditto them.
That's good.
Well, it was interesting, Claire, because when we were talking about this, I very much think of myself as writing about the real problems in the real world. You know, I have these women running a health clinic for sex workers in Manhattan. The economy's tanking. They're, like, constantly in danger of being evicted in gentrification. They're constantly in danger of losing their funding. There have been attacks on, you know, birth control and birth control funding. These are all things that are very much in our world. But as we were talking, you pointed out, and I think you're right, that while I'm writing about the problems in the world, I've created sort of a group of women who are deeply connected and unified, and there's sort of a utopian little circle of women who have decided that they're all going to sort of put everything on the line to fight for this clinic and to fight for their community. So I think for me, that's the balance, that I am dealing with the real problems in the real world, but I sort of create these sort of extreme kind of fantasy groups of women who are going to battle them. And it was interesting because up until very, very late in the process, like maybe 6 months before the book came out, 8 months before the book came out, I finally added an element of betrayal from within that community, because previously everyone was just down for each other start to finish, which is can be a bit utopian.
I think that is the definition of a utopia, is we are down for each other. I like it. I chose the former route. I decided to take structures that already exist and really not to underline them, but to take them to their furthest possible extreme. So in my first book, I wanted to write about violence against women and what happens when gender parity is way, way lost. So I wrote a book about a plague. The plague kills off almost everyone on Earth, but it disproportionately affects women and children, with the result that there are 10 men left on Earth for every one woman. with numbers like that, I can really exaggerate problems that I see now, and I can take them to their furthest possible iteration. And then it allows me to draw into my big tent feminism issues of trans people and non-binary people and their place in a world where gender is such an issue. So I do think that you can run the risk of re-entrenching those ideals in your readers. You can never really control how people read your books. I get letters from people who've read my books in ways I have nightmares about. But I think one of the great things about science fiction is that it allows us to take these things to the far future, to the nth degree, and say not only if, but like, dude, what if? And I learned that from writers like Octavia Butler, like Margaret Atwood, and P.D. James.
I think the mystery or crime fiction genre has a pretty long tradition of feminist writers. Like, there's a pretty strong subgenre of feminist crime fiction, and writers like Val McDermott and Barbara Neely, and even, I would say, Elizabeth George, who, you know, write real complex female characters dealing with real problems. So in that sense, it's not that difficult to be in that writing in that genre and reflecting the world as it is, but with the complexity of the real world and real women making real choices or facing real obstacles. The problem, one problem, however, is, you know, unlike literary fiction, mysteries have to tie up neatly and have clues that are somehow in plain sight enough that the reader feels clued in and then easily missable by the protagonist. So it's a highly unreal situation for anyone to be in. And then if you're layering on top of that, I mean, my goal with writing these books about Palestine was to show what life in Palestine is like and what the lives of Palestinians are like. But I chose a protagonist that isn't exactly like anyone I ever met, although she certainly has elements of people that I knew. And so I'm trying to represent someone that could certainly exist in Palestine, but doesn't precisely exist, and at the same time not play into the Orientalism and objectification of Muslim and Arab women, so that I don't want people going, oh, wouldn't it be nice if Arab women could really be this liberated? Because I know plenty of Arab women, of Palestinian women, who are just as liberated as Rania, my Palestinian policewoman. They just don't happen to be policewomen. And so that's the tension that I'm always flirting with.
In Dietland, I think the major inequality that I'm dealing with is fat phobia, particularly the way it intersects.
I'm sorry, Sarah, could you put that? I can't even hear you, so I'm guessing they can't hear you very well.
Is that better?
That's better, yeah, thank you.
So in Dietland, what I'm examining primarily is fat phobia and the way that it intersects with misogyny. And so the book starts out sort of in the terrain that we're most familiar with and stories about fat people, like the miserable fat person who's desperate to lose weight so that their real life can begin and they can find true love, that sort of terrain. So I really tried to write about the reality of that in a quite brutal way, even though I use some surreal elements. And then partway through the book, I kind of explode that. Using different elements, I would say a revenge fantasy runs through it. There's a terrorist group called Jennifer, who's a feminist avenger, who's quite violent and is terrorizing misogynists in society. So it's sort of exploring violent revolution. And then I also use some utopian elements, I think, which historically feminists and womanist writers have done, thinking of like Alice Walker, The Color Purple, or Marge Piercy, I mean, so many. Because one of the things I think feminists can do is say, what if, you know, what if we didn't have to live the way that we do? And I think one of the great things about fiction is that it can explore what those alternatives look like. So what if, you know, this woman who weighs 300 pounds decided to give up dieting and accept herself as she is? What would that look like? Or what would it look like if a feminist avenger attacked society you know, I'm not necessarily advocating for that, but what would that look like? I mean, that's one of the things that you can do in fiction that you can't do in nonfiction. So I think that there's a way to sort of look at these inequalities in a realistic way and then use the fun parts of being a fiction writer and use different elements, surreal elements, utopian, fantasy, and kind of have fun playing with it that way.
All right. So one of the things that that we've all talked about, oh, and I should mention, there is a wonderful piece in the Huffington Post. Do you remember the title of the piece?
No, but I can pull it up.
Okay. There's a piece in the Huffington Post which three of you, I believe, in preparation for this panel, three of our writers spoke to the Huffington Post and gave a lot of really foundational answers to a lot of these questions. So we're jumping off of this piece. I highly recommend you read it. But one of the things that that you all were talking about was the co-optation of feminism in the media, and how that plays into this idea of the strong female protagonist. And the question of is a strong, well, first of all, what does strong female protagonist mean? What does strong mean? And is that always feminist? The question of fetishizing kick-ass females for the male gaze. And the question of choice feminism, i.e., feminism that, or the idea that feminism is just about giving women, individual women, every choice that they could possibly have, which I think a lot of feminists, or most feminists, agree is not really feminism. So there's a whole complex of issues around the co-optation of feminism into the media, and I want to get at these specifically in fiction and in the genre fiction, in the fiction genres that you all are writing in. So I wanted actually to start with you, Sarah, and just continue with what you were saying about representing. I mean, you've used a whole bunch of different tactics to get at what an alternative to living in this world would look like. How do you address in your genre and in your writing, how do you address the co-optation of feminism, and how do you see that playing out in your work?
I think Dietland takes a little bit more of a radical stance in its feminism. And so I think it actually has made, I think, some feminists angry, I guess, when they read it at different aspects of it. So it, in part, I think it's a debate about feminism within the book. I mean, one of the things I think the book does is that you can just read it and not really pick up on these other arguments that are in it or the subtext in it. So it depends on the reader and how they're reading it. But I think I try and address these issues, particularly of choice. For example, you know, do we, well, at the heart of the novel is a woman who's planning to have weight loss surgery. So there's a question at the heart of the novel, why does she want to have this surgery? And you know, there's all these reasons about can you make a choice to have a procedure like that in a society where fat people are hated, so that it's not really a choice because the one option is continue to live in this body where you face tremendous abuse and marginalization in society, and the other option, the surgery, is that you can assimilate yourself and gain the benefits of that in society. So how do you even make a choice like that? Is it a choice, and what influences those choices that a person might make? And, you know, in the novel, the character makes her choice, but I've had women readers who have made other choices, who've had weight loss surgery, who loved the book as well and weren't upset by it because they just, you know, they agreed with it in many ways. It's just kind of an impossible situation, you know, that we all find ourselves in trying to cope and live in this society. So I think that there's many different ways that I try and examine that in the novel. That's just one example of a choice. And
that's interesting because what I was talking about with Aya and sex work, excuse me, and women using their mastery of appearance and performative sexuality to make patriarchal bargains. Can you talk a little bit about that in your work?
Yeah, I mean, one of the things there's within feminism, there are all these battles about sex work. Is it feminist? Is it not feminist? And I mean, I can see different arguments about it. I think, but the place that I always land is the problem here isn't sex work or sex workers. The problem is men's financial domination of the globe. And so we live in a world where men own upwards of 90% of the wealth. And so what that means is that in order to live, women need to figure out how to access that wealth. And basically, there's like maybe 1% of women who inherit some of it and then don't have to make these choices. But for the other 99% of us, there are really kind of three things you can do. You can earn wages. You can work to earn wages so that you can live. Then one that is, you know, very elevated in many societies is you can get married to a man who has access to that wealth, and you can provide, you know, some call it love, others call it providing emotional and sexual labor and possibly child raising labor within that relationship. And both can be true, but we're not talking about you and your relationship. We're talking about how things are set up globally, right? And then the third sort of option is you can provide sexual and emotional labor services in a freelance fashion, and that's really sex work, right? And so what gets set up in the society is women who make different choices battling each other, right? I choose to have children. I don't choose to have children. Now we're going to be set up, you know, as a cage match. I'm a mom who chooses to work. I'm a mom who chooses not to work. Mommy wars. So those folks are set up against each other. And everybody's set up against sex workers, right? So these are all sort of these setups about how women get pitted against each other based on what are the choices that we make to try and make our lives in a financially male-dominated world. So I think one of the things that I found as a writer prior to writing this series, which, you know, it's urban fiction, it's very gritty, it's very sexually explicit, and these are women who are sex workers, so part of their success is based on them being pretty commercially attractive, and then that's also part of the appeal of the series, definitely is engaging the male gaze in that way. And part of that is I wrote other books before, and people would look at me and be like, who's going to buy this? Like, I don't know. You know, it was like black women, you know, fighting sexism and racism in college. And people were kind of like, rrr. So one of the things that I realized is part of the intersection of racism and sexism for black women and black women's stories is that there are certain things about African heritage women's stories that the mainstream is interested in, and sex is really one of them. So I was like, okay, I'm trying to sell a book, and clearly the book is going to need to have more sexual content than I've been writing to be more successful. So if I'm going to write stuff with more sexual content, then I want it to be really politicized sexual content. And sex work is just a really politicized location because sex work sits at the intersection of gender, commerce, race, nationality, socioeconomic class. And so by creating this sex work community, it became an opportunity to comment on all of that, to comment on sex trafficking, to comment on to comment on the collusion between corporations and sex trafficking. So for me, that was the way that I wanted to work with characters who were very consciously figuring out how to utilize the male gaze to make a living and to make their lives work, but also were creating a supportive environment to help give women more choices there. And I guess the last thing that I'll say about the individual badass heroine, I think, and I see in a lot of our work, that it's not really just sort of, it's not about the lone woman out there in that same way that the connections between women and the communities that women build are such an important way of engaging feminism within a genre.
Okay, so
Megan Kay, your genres, mystery, crime fiction, slash thriller, which kind of is a continuum, and science fiction, post-apocalyptic fiction, and dystopian fiction, also a continuum, are particularly subject to the kick-ass woman figure. So I want to both of you to address that, and also feel free to respond to anything that Sarah and Aya have said as well, and in whatever order you'd like to take it.
Well, I mean, in crime fiction, the mainstream kick-ass woman is incredibly gorgeous, always going around in high heels and something highly inappropriate for the season, and yet capable at any second of, like, throwing a guy over her shoulder. And the other thing is that she's got to be brilliant enough to find the clues and solve the case that baffled all the police, but, you know, and the teams of FBI agents, but somehow stupid enough not to realize that the guy she's sleeping with is the killer. So it's kind of impossible to fit into that genre in a serious feminist way. You know, like, so these are the tropes. And honestly, I have to say, I think television has done a better job in a lot of ways of dealing with the sort of real issues of, well, if you're going off in the middle of the night to set a trap for the killer, who is taking care of the kids? Mm-hmm. And what are the kids, how do the kids feel when you miss their recital for the third time? Like, what's their reaction to that? You know, television, I think, has done a better job than a lot of novels. So I was really wanting to put those issues front and center. And the other thing is that, you know, kick-ass always means with a gun. And so, like, I had the option. In the U.S., you know, police means with a gun, but in Palestine, police are dealing with a very complex political situation, because in some situations they're not allowed to carry guns, and just the fact that they may be armed makes them extra suspect to the Israeli authorities. So not... police doesn't always mean guns. So I chose not to have Rania be armed most of the time. And that was one way that I sort of tried to counter the tropes, and that she's very small. And she doesn't, I mean, basically her skills are not physical skills per se, although she was a slingshot expert in her youth in the refugee camp. You know, which actually sort of came from a friend of mine, although her thing was that she wasn't good at throwing, and that's why she ended up in the position to be like the special aide to the prime minister for a long time. But that be that as it may. I mean, the other thing, though, is trying to write a lesbian mystery and trying to write something that would appeal to lesbians. You know, it never was any question to me that, for me, that one of my protagonists was going to be a lesbian. And if there's a lesbian, they should have sex. But then, because it's not only about her, and because it's not primarily about queer issues, that they're in the background, some people reacted badly to the fact that the lesbian sex scene happens, spoiler alert if anybody buys my book, that it happens somewhere like page 240 or something. And many people, including lesbians, had a very bad reaction to that. I mean, I was really surprised when I had a promo which resulted in a lot of people reading my book who wouldn't maybe be my core audience. And I started getting these reviews on Amazon saying, well, this was a pretty good book, but that lesbian sex scene was just disgusting. And they were, as far as I could tell, all straight men. And I was like, but I thought straight men are supposed to like lesbian sex. And then people were like, yeah, but that lesbian sex scene wasn't for them.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So, you know, that's sort of the issue when you're trying to be super complex and represent the world as it is, you often end up not doing anything quite as well as if people want you to be doing it.
That's so true. So in science fiction, the badass female character is practically a registered trademark. If you picture Ripley from Alien or Sarah Connor from Terminator or even River Song from Serenity, Firefly, she is always conventionally hot. She is never interested in anything traditionally considered to be feminine because she's cool, she's one of the guys, and she definitely only wants to fuck guys. All of these things have to be accepted. So I knew the danger when I was trying to write a female protagonist in a post-apocalyptic world is that it would just turn into competence porn. And of course she can shoot a gun. Of course she can throw a guy over her shoulder. Of course she can fight physically. And I had to rethink all of that. And I decided to write a queer character because it was of deep importance to me, and then I had to take it a step further because, as I mentioned, in the world where there are 10 men to every one woman, the safest way to walk the streets is to look like a man. So I have a cross-dressing protagonist who has to grapple with her own gender identity, and in doing that, she finds herself cut off from her own femininity in her body and in all of her practices, and she has to deal with that. So I wanted to reckon with all of those heroes who have traded in, you know, cupcakes and anything glittery and gotten a great big gun. And I think that there's so much more work to do with that in science fiction. There are still so many trademark badass female characters, and that we're just starting to see the mold being broken. And I'm very pleased to be part of that.
Great. You guys are doing all my work for me. This is fabulous. So the next thing I wanted to address is the audience for your particular genre, their expectations, their tastes, their desires, their wish fulfillment. How does the genre address those? How do you address those in your fiction? And I want to start with Kate, because you were already starting to get into that with talking about the reactions to the sex scene, because sex scenes are, you know, for who reads mystery here? So we have a... Yeah, who reads mystery? So yes, there's a question of whether or not you're going to get a sex scene in a particular detective series. But they're always expected or welcome when they come. And so basically, if you could tease out a little bit more, not just the sex scene, but all of the elements of the genre that are speaking to a particular genre audience, and how you are either addressing those or debunking them.
Yeah, I mean, I sort of went into this not quite understanding all the rules about genre and crime fiction. So, for instance, there is something called cozy, which, for people who don't know, are like books that don't have a lot of graphic violence and don't usually have bad language and have usually an amateur detective. So in certain ways, my book could have been a cozy, but it also turns out that cozies cannot have sex. And so I end up not being eligible, for instance, for some awards that I might have liked to be eligible for because I have graphic sex in my book. So, you know, maybe I didn't do my research that well. But, I mean, the other thing was that I sort of thought I was doing what Aya was talking about, of writing something that would appeal to a broad audience that might not intentionally pick up a book about Palestine, but, you know, likes mysteries and international mysteries and likes to learn about other cultures through fiction and would just pick up this book. And what I didn't realize was that you can't use the word Palestine if you want to be writing a mainstream book. So I limited my core audience in a certain way. But that being said, certainly it has gotten to people who, you know, because it's feminist fiction and because I was able to get reviews in some feminist journals, you know, magazines, like, it has gotten some people to read about Palestine who wouldn't otherwise have chosen it, and it's definitely gotten people to read about lesbians and lesbian sex who wouldn't have chosen it, whether they liked it or not. And some of them presumably did, and maybe some of them even learned something. so, you know, so that's... that's some of what I have. I feel like I've learned more. One thing I feel like is it wasn't queer enough in a certain way for queer audiences, and that was a big part of who I thought I was writing for. So my second one has a lot more overt queer content and sex up front, so people will know what they're getting into. And, you know, I guess I feel good about that, although I also feel sad about that in some ways, because I've always wanted, you know, I don't know how many of you remember or even saw the, you know, it's an older crowd, so a lot of you probably saw the movie Liana by John Sayles. And I really couldn't stand that movie, which I know puts me in a minority, but I really felt like if she were not a lesbian, there would be nothing interesting about that character. And I was never going to do that. I was never going to write a lesbian character whose only purpose for being there was being a lesbian. Like, I've always wanted to write books where people just happen to be gay or lesbian, and that every story that has gay people at the center doesn't have to be about being gay. And so, to a certain extent, it makes me a little sad to feel like even now in 2011, it's hard to do that and have it be recognized as a queer book.
So you said something that Aya actually said in the interview in Huffington Post, which is that you were trying to sneak in progressive ideas and values through a very tropey genre, and you were hoping that the genre audience would accept those values. This is something that I call stealth progressivism. And so Aya and I were talking about that. So Meg and I, could both of you talk about that? Because I kind of get the feeling that both of you were aiming for that in your work. Can you address that and also address what Kate was saying?
Go, please.
Definitely. I mean, one of the things that when I was writing this, I started writing it, and right in the middle of working on it, 50 Shades of Grey happened, right? And so it was like, okay, clearly there is a lot of appetite for more sexually explicit content than people had thought, but that this is going in a direction that is not compatible with my feminist values. And so I got really interested in thinking about what are the appetites. Like, and young women are being conditioned to have appetites. Like, clearly the society and all of the media and yada, yada. You know, I have a small kid and I'm watching the conditioning start, right? So women are conditioned to have certain appetites. And as a feminist, I feel like, you know, as a younger feminist, it was my job to be like, I will not have those appetites. And if I feel myself having those appetites, I will not indulge those appetites. Arr! You know, and then kind of like over here, maybe have the guilty pleasure with this or that, right? So I think I was trying to integrate that and think, what are the appetites that women are conditioned to have? Definitely there are these significant appetites around romance and like the happy ending and all those tropes. Like, I don't read in the romance genre, but I've seen a bazillion rom-coms over the years, and it's the same story structure. Like, I know that structure, and a decently written rom-com at the end, I'm like, oh, you know, so I have all the right feels. So I was like, okay, I'm going to take on the romance genre and I'm going to engage those tropes. And then I also thought about chick lit, like what's going on in chick lit. And I've read some of it and am familiar with some of it. So I was like, the one thing I was like, somebody is going shopping and they're going to end up with some shoes within the first 30 pages of this book. So like, I got the shoes in there because it's important. And then also like with this sexually charged material, and like I was saying before, part of the book was about like, okay, there's going to be a lot of sex. And I just really was like, can I have 10 different kinds of sex in this book? I don't think I got 10, but you know, like I have sort of sex within a romantic thing where people are bonding for life. There's straight sex, there's queer sex, there's compulsive sex, there's sex work sex, there's, you know, TMI sex. There's just like all this different sex, right? And I was like, okay, I want to have a lot of sort of something for everybody sex. And then the other thing that was really important for me, and then there's the heist, right, and sort of the action. So then there would just be all these times where there's like action, and then, you know, women backstabbing each other is, you know, another important trope of urban lit and chick lit. So I was like, okay, how can I get some catty women in here fighting, you know? So I was like, okay. But with all of these tropes, particularly the tropes that I find, you know, less compatible with feminism, it was like, and how can I fuck with this? You know, how can I have women fighting each other, but something is really clear about the context of why it's happening, or, you know, women are really, it's clear that there's some internalized sexism happening on one side, but the other folks are like, actually, no, this isn't my battle. So figuring out how to play with those tropes of competition between women so that it's in there, but that the overall gaze of the book isn't like, yeah, girl, we just got to fight. That's just how it is. Like, no, that's not true. It happens, and it's a symptom of our society. And the same thing with the romance. Like, there are all these romantic tropes like, she wants to, but she can't, right? You know, and my thing is like, well, girl, if you want to, like, you know, talk it over with your therapist. If it's a good idea, do it. If it's not, get some support around not doing it, right? But that doesn't make a good romance. So, you know, it's like, she wants to, but she can't. So then I had to come up with these scenes where there's like all this tension and, oh, I mustn't. Oh, but maybe I could, you know? And to me, that was really fun to figure out how to make that interesting. So there are a couple of scenes and like one scene that I love, you know. Oh, and then there's all this stuff about like women and sort of being a little bit weak and a little bit helpless, right? Like that's sort of part of it. So anyway, there's this scene, the guy has this big box and the protagonist is like trying to take the box and whatever. She's like, no, no. And he has to help her. And so they're very close. And she's like, no, oh, I'm having all these feelings, right? And so she like can't, she needs his help, right? So there's this little sort of weak and helpless moment. And then this other woman comes up who's like really butch and an athlete. And she's like, oh, I'll take the box, right? And she's like, boop, and takes the box. So it's like, even though this particular protagonist is having a moment, the comment isn't like, oh, girls, aren't we just all weak and helpless at the core? It's like, no, there are lots of different kinds of women. There are lots of different ways that we are in our bodies. So that was really important to me to figure out how to negotiate these tropes so that it doesn't have sort of an ultimately comment. It doesn't have a deep and negative comment about women's power overall, that it really is sort of one moment with one character. And also, I had to fight, because these things have to like happen over and over, I had to fight to think about ways that it could be, I wouldn't necessarily say realistic, but reasonable or interesting. Like, for example, in book two, The Boss, you know, you have these romantic arcs and they get together and everything's going great. And then something has to happen to break them up, right? That's got to happen. Otherwise, the arc won't work. And so, spoiler alert, she's dating this rapper and they're in love and everything's great. And, you know, what could possibly happen to break them up? Well, they're on a date and he reports that he's doing an album with R. Kelly. And she is a black girl from Chicago and R. Kelly is, you know, a serial statutory rapist of young girls. And she loses her shit and like cusses him out and dumps him, and then it goes into a flashback of her and a friend who was affected by him. And the publisher said, I can't call him R. Kelly, so I call him Car. First I called him Har Kelly, and they were like, no. So I call him Car Willis, but it's obviously him, right? Yeah. And so, you know, there become, like Kay was saying, there are all these opportunities in these genres to explore a particular world and to explore different political issues along the way when you're kind of on these genre roads.
I've been very lucky in science fiction that science fiction has been responsible for stealthing progressive values to Americans for a long time. I mean, a lot of people grappled with the first idea that they might be racists because they watched Star Trek. So I had a lot to work with there. But the weird thing about science fiction is that although it's very progressive on issues of racism and classism and the role of technology in our society and aging and all these controversial issues, it sucks at feminism almost all the time. So, like, my favorite example of this is if you watch something that's about an android or an AI shaped like a Fassbender or like Data from Star Trek, the question is it human? Does it have a soul? What can it teach us? Does it want to be more like us? And if you have an android shaped like Scarlett Johansson, the question is, how do I put my dick in it? We can't see AI shaped like women as people because we don't see women as people. So when I set out to write this book, I was going to have to stealth some progressivism into a story of survival after the apocalypse. And I've gotten a lot of reviews from men who say they have a hard time identifying with the protagonist. And I'd like to gently push back on that without speaking directly to any of my reviewers, because that's not my business, by saying it is possible that maybe you were not conditioned to identify with a protagonist who is female. If you speak to most of the women in your life, they will tell you exactly what it's like to be Harry Potter. They've been him. It is time for you to learn to be Hermione.
Mm. All right. I agree. So, Sarah, correct me if I'm wrong, but you approached writing your book outside of the confines of genre tropes, yes? So did you find yourself butting up against any tropes in your own mind as you were writing? And did you have to make any of these compromises or do any of these things that the other writers had to do?
Yeah, I mean, you're talking about stealth. I was thinking about the stealth marketing of the book, for example, the cover. This one has the cherry. The hardcover had a cupcake. So I think I was thinking about the marketing. The executive director of marketing at Houghton Mifflin, Carla Gray, who any of you might be in the publishing industry might know who she is, and she's passed away last week, very unexpectedly. And she did such a great job with this book, trying to get it into booksellers' hands, because I think that it didn't fit into any kind of real category, and she worked tirelessly to try and promote the book. But I think it was tricky because there isn't really, in terms of literary fiction, there's not really a lot of feminist, explicitly feminist literary fiction today, where there was in the 70s and 80s. And so I was trying to revive that genre, if I could, a little bit with Dietland. But I think in terms of what I was kind of bumping up against, I guess, is just this idea of the woman's novel, because basically any novel by a woman is the woman's novel, except for a few women who escape that and get to be called literary writers, the handful of them, who you often don't write about women, perhaps that's why. But some of my book, you know, I was writing about this young woman who was living in New York, who was working in the magazine industry, and it's sort of like chick lit sort of owns that now, you know, because I had that experience. I lived in New York and I worked in magazines, so some of what I was writing about kind of came from my real life, but it was like, oh, well, you can't write about that if you're not writing chick lit, because everyone's going to think, oh, well, this is chick lit. And, you know, chick lit's fine, but that's not what I was writing. And so I was kind of resentful of it, because when I was early in the novel, I kind of took some of it to a workshop when I was doing an MFA. And people were like, oh, that's chick lit. I'm like, no, it's not. It's not chick lit. It's more influenced by Fight Club. That was one of my inspirations.
That's what it is.
The feminist Fight Club, yes. And so I started to push back against some of those chick lit tropes. So basically I decided, okay, I'm going to write a novel that seems like a chick lit novel at the beginning, and then I'm going to explode it, like violently explode it. And so it was weird because some readers didn't realize what kind of novel they were reading, which is kind of how the book works, I guess, kind of stealthy. And then when it blows up and becomes something else, some readers loved it and some readers got really angry. You know, they're reading this novel about this miserable fat woman, and then there's like men dropped out of airplanes into the Sierra Nevada. And they're like, what's going on? You know, we live in a world with such violence, like, you know, on television, even before prime time, you have people getting shot in the head and you just graphic violence. But when you put violence in a book like this, it's like, well, you're not allowed to do that. That's not the kind of book that you're writing. And so I guess while I was writing the book, I was just trying to play with what kind of book am I allowed to write about women? And it was very influenced in part by in some aspects by Fight Club and this sort of this angry and defiant spirit of Fight Club, and trying to say women should get to have stories like that too. And so that's what I tried to do. But and a lot of women love it, and a lot of women really resist it and get angry. So it's just the question of audience, I think, is tricky. But in the end, I just wrote the book that I wanted to write, and hopefully it finds the readers that need it and want it.
Awesome, yeah. Yeah.
And I just have to say, if you haven't read Dietland, you really
have
to
read it.
It's really incredible.
It is
and
so good.
And I also would say, if you hate women enough, then you get to be literary fiction like Gillian Flynn.
It's true.
Keep talking to each other. I'm going to throw in one question more. We have about 10 minutes before we open this up to Q&A, and I want you all to talk to each other about this. And that is, of course, we are living in an era of intersectional feminism. Come join us in the intersectional feminist world. And all of you are intersecting your feminist ideals and your characters' status as women in your worlds with other identities. Please talk to each other and the audience about that, and in whatever order and however you would like.
I think one of the intersections of feminism we talk about the least is the intersection of being a woman and ability in the body. I'm not qualified to write a disabled protagonist, but I have disabled people in my life, so I imagine them in my fiction. So I spent 5 years studying American Sign Language as a community college student. I'm not qualified as an interpreter, but I'm near fluent. I can order a pizza, you know. But when I started thinking about the most disadvantaged women in this extremely disadvantaged system in the world that I've created, I started thinking about women who were, much like if anybody's watching The Handmaid's Tale, there are women who have certain physical disabilities who are still considered qualified breeders. So there's a minor character in my first book who's a deaf girl. And not only is she the only deaf person in her society, but she's the only woman for a long time. And when she finally meets another woman, she's so excited to see her, and she's desperately signing over and over, trying to tell this woman what her name is, or what she's been through, or how she's feeling. And the other woman only ever learns a few words. She's more isolated than anybody else in that world can possibly imagine. So I think examining the intersection of feminism and disability is always important. There are so many things that we overlook if we are able-bodied that always need to be talked about.
Yeah, I agree. As someone who's been dealing with a disability, I really, really hear that. This is something that that I am particularly interested in with regard to chick lit and popular lit, because there is a lot dealing with appearance in that genre, but not a lot with disability, unless I'm mistaken.
Yeah, I'm not an expert on chick lit, but I think, yeah, I would be surprised if it you know, it was just more the kind of traditional heroine that you might find in any kind of romance novel. But maybe, Aya, do you?
Well, one of the things I was going to say that I love about Dietland, there are a couple of things. One is the book. So there's this book within a book, Fuckability Theory, which is just like so great in terms of both the satire and the social commentary that you have going on in there. And the other thing that I was going to say, too, that's really interesting is there's so much, you know, because there is this sort of suspense thriller aspect, there's all this stealth stuff going on. So, I mean, I don't sort of want to spoil it, but then there are these racial moments that sort of pop up out of nowhere that are really interesting. So, you know, I heard you say earlier that you're really looking at the intersection of fat phobia and misogyny, but you're actually looking at so many different things. Mm-hmm. Like, there are so many layers. There are pieces around class. There are pieces around race. There's so much in there.
And specifically on the subject of appearance in Dietland, there's a thing that happens to almost every fat character if we are to commiserate with her in any way. We're told she's fat, but she's a very pretty face. Or she's fat, but she had beautiful long hair. Or she's fat, but she's so sweet. And she's nice to everybody. Serene never does that. She writes a fat woman who does not get excused. She's not one of the good fatties. She's just a person.
Oh, thank you. Thank you for all this kind feedback. Yeah, I think interesting talking about you know, the main character being a fat white woman. And that's kind of, because it's a first person story, so that was the lens that I was looking through, since that's what I'm most familiar with. But then was that idea of how to incorporate the stories of so many different women in the community that she joins, and trying to look at all of these problems through the different lenses, like look at the common thread of this cultural misogyny, and then see how the women experience it in different ways depending on how they're placed in society, which was, as a fiction writer, was one of the really interesting things to get to kind of inhabit these different worlds. So I guess I can't say too much about one aspect of it because I don't want to spoil it, but yeah, that is one kind of hard thing that I haven't been able to talk about. I think you know what I'm talking about because I don't want to spoil it. So
right.
I guess with nonfiction, you don't have that problem. But
yeah, no, it's great, and I think that there's also that really interesting moment where the things conspire so that there are some dating situations, and that's also like so. I thought that was so brilliant because that is such a part of women's literature, like looking for love, you know. And so it was like the way that you're really messing with that in the book, I think, is just so powerful.
And it's interesting thinking about audience, because women will read that. There's a scene where the character goes on a bunch of blind dates with different men, but they're fixed up with her, but they don't know what she looks like. And a lot of thin women read that, and they've told me, oh, that wouldn't happen. And then fat women who read it say, that's exactly what would happen. So I think as readers as well, you the way you interpret things is very much influenced by, you know, your own experience of life. And some readers saying, oh, well, she wouldn't be treated that awful. You're exaggerating. Which, you know, is a good thing. If people are open-minded and they read a novel about someone who has a very different experience than them. Because I think fiction can allow you to be in someone's skin in a way that nothing else can, not even film or television. And they've even done brain scans of people after they've read novels that show that there can be changes in the brain even for a couple of days afterwards. So in that way, it's, you know, we think of the kind of resisting reader, the reader who resists the text, but perhaps that they can also get something out of it as well.
That puts me in mind of a very important PSA, and I try to share it with as many people as I can. If someone tells you that they've had an experience, don't tell them that doesn't happen because you've never seen it.
Yeah.
That actually puts me in mind, particularly your story about the lesbian sex scene offending people, puts me in mind of a fantasy series by Laurie J. Marks called the Elemental Logic series. Highly recommended. And it's a world in which men and women are absolutely equal. And the way that plays out is very, very strange. But you have equal time given to female and male characters. And I read this, the first book in the series, and I thought, oh, you know, this is so boring. There's just too many women in this. And then I realized I was thinking that, and I was like, I can't believe I thought that. You know, as a feminist, I can't believe I thought that, because it was really genuinely equal time. Have you yourselves had that experience where you've read something that's truly feminist and you thought, oh no, it's too much?
I don't know that I think for me in the genres that I read in, like, I'm always looking for more. You know, I feel like, and that's part, for me, that's part of, you know, the decision to write was that I'm writing the books that I could never quite find. And I think part of it has to do with intersectionality. Like, you know, I want action, and I want, like, you know, things to work out, but I don't want it to be shallow and kind of like, oh yeah, like these hard things happened to her, but she realized it and she told her, you know, cousin about it, and then that solved, like, you know, the deep childhood abuse that she had, right? You know, like I want those optimistic, you know, dare I say, happy endings, but I want people to, like, work for them and fight for them in the ways that people really fight, you know, to have their lives, the ways that people who have come through trauma really fight to have things go well. And I think, you know, in writing Heist, I want people to steal the money and then I want them to get away with it, you know? And I can say spoiler alert, but, you know, y'all see me and what I'm about, like, you can't believe that I want her to give the money back to the sex traffickers, you know? So it's like, I think for me, in terms of the intersections, like, I want everybody in these books. Like, I wanted to get everybody in there. And, you know, I was just sort of writing a list. I appreciated what folks said about ability. You know, it was really important to me to have a character with a disability who was really powerful in there, and I do. It was important to me to have folks kind of across a spectrum of age, women working together across an age spectrum. Clearly, there's a lot around class, because sex work, you know, generally has to do with women who don't have access to a lot of economic resources, who are like, all I have to work with here is my body.
So I'm just going to ask everyone to give a last thought before we turn to questions.
Cool. And the one thing that I want to say, too, that has been important for me is just the presence of queer women and trans women in the book. And I don't have a romantic storyline for the queer women. I have a trans woman storyline that I'm working on, in part because the lesbians are sort of the romantic moral compass of the book. And it's the sort of the equality that they're able to figure out as women together that grounds the community. And so that's been interesting to me to think about that intersection as well.
I think my final thought kind of dovetails into your last question, is it's the kind of the way that even as a feminist author, you can overlook some things. And I love 19th century literature. I read a lot of it. And I spent a lot of time as a Jane Austen hater. And I was like, oh, Marriage Pots, so boring. Oh, Comedies of Men are so dull. And I realized I had found a way to devalue the contributions of almost every woman in that century. And I didn't realize I was doing it because I had internalized my own literary misogyny and how much her contemporaries hated her. So I think that it's important to find books by people who look like you, who think differently. And it's very important to find books by people who don't look like you and to look at their experience and say that is real and that happened. It is uncomfortable. It will challenge your thoughts. Sit with it. It will make you a better person.
Yeah.
I mean, I guess I just want to say that I kind of don't use the word intersectional because I feel like it's so overused that I'm waiting to see a Coke commercial that has something to do with intersectionality. You know, but I do feel like the thing I really try to keep in front of my mind all the time when I'm writing, and especially because I'm writing from the point of view of many characters who have a lot less privilege than me, and in a direct, you know, I'm a Jewish American writing about Palestinians, and that's a very fraught thing to do, and you can go wrong in a lot of ways. So the thing I just really try to keep in front of my mind is realness. And I guess more than intersectional feminism, what I look for in books and what I try to put out, and I'm sure fall way short, is real feminism.
So just about anything we want, our final, final comment.
Anything at all, yeah.
Well, one of the things I've been doing recently is that my book is being adapted into a television series.
Woo! Yeah.
Thank you. By Marty Noxon, the woman who did Unreal. So I've been living in L.A., going in the writer's room, and thinking about the, first of all, the shock that this might actually end up on TV, something like this, because I don't think, you know, I think the landscape of television is changing a lot because there's more avenues now for diversity and different types of stories. But one of the things I've been thinking about is just in a novel, when you're talking about the issue of appearance, one of the great things about a novel is that you can have characters that look any kind of way, right, because no one can see them, you just imagine them. And now it's being translated into a very visual medium. So that's something that I've just been kind of thinking about how that how that's going to change the perhaps feminist politics of the book. But they have been having auditions for the main character, and some actresses have been turned away because they're not fat enough. So that's a first, I bet, in Hollywood history. So anyway, a new medium, and see how we can translate our feminist stories into film and television and theater and
excellent.
One of the great things about it.
Yes.
I just want to give that that title that you asked for in the Huffington Post. Women writers face major hurdles, especially in best-selling genres, by Maddie Krum, C-R-U-M. That's women writers face major hurdles, especially in best-selling genres.
Yeah. Okay, so we have time for some questions. There's our first question. Do we have a mic? Do we have a mic? Okay, they'll bring it to you. This woman over here in the turquoise shirt first. Excellent. And then you next.
Hi, my name is...
Sorry, I can't hear you.
Mic's not on.
Turn the mic on, please.
Could you just put it closer? That's fine. I can bring it closer. Hi, my name... Sorry.
There we go.
My name is Corbett O'Toole. And I first of all wanted to thank you so much for mentioning disability because it's so rarely mentioned. I also kind of, you didn't really touch on this very much, but I also want to raise the issue about the ability of people writing from, like, in my example, from a disability perspective, not being able to find publishers. So I'm actually in the position where I had a book that was a finalist in 2016 for Lambda, but by the time it got named as one of the five books for U.S. Women by the Women's March, it was out of print because that the small press had dumped it. So I'm actually in the process of starting a new press, and we have five books, two fiction books, three nonfiction books, three of the books are by disabled people, three of the books are by disabled people of color, and I'm kind of sad. The books are fabulous books, really well written, definitely stuff that could be published by any kind of a publisher, but they hear the word disability and they don't think it applies. So like the census says one in five Americans has a disability, and yet when I went looking for any kind of analysis on diversity that included disability, it's not out there. And when I went to Amazon, Amazon has almost 21 million books, and less than one-third of 1% have anything to do with disability, so it's kind of this double-sided. Mm-hmm. And I want to give a shout-out to a fiction writer I just read.
But before you give a shout-out, can you give us the name of your new press?
Sorry, thank you, Claire. It's called Reclamation Press.
Reclamation Press.
And you'll be seeing it because we have to raise $25,000 to get the books published because
Do you have a question for our panelists?
No, but I did want to give a shout out to a fiction book that had really addressed disability in a really unusual and wonderful way that I just read. It's a book called Borderline. It's in the sci-fi genre, and it's by Michelle, M-I-S-H-E-L-L, Baker.
Baker, Borderline.
And it's a character that's both borderline psych disability and amputee. It's a fabulous book.
Thank you.
It's really good. It's also technically urban fantasy.
So another turquoise-ish top right there.
Turquoise folks only.
Yeah, so when you're writing as a white, straight man, you don't carry any of this stuff that that we're all talking about here, and you just kind of write the books that you want to write. Which, and as a fiction writer myself, it's like, what I'm struck by is we can really get trapped into this overthinking everything and staying in that left brain, really, like, what do I need to include? Who do I need to put there? And I'm just curious about, and what am I saying, and who's going to read it this way and that way? And I feel like, that's a lot of what's being talked about here today. And so the other piece of this is, how do you balance that with really just accessing your own voice and imagination and not getting too caught up in that left brain piece of it? I find it challenging, and I'm wondering if you have comments on that.
Although I am a person with many privileges that I'm very willing to own, I have to say I wrote the book I wanted to write. The first day I had the idea for this, I had to wait because I was in finals at Cal. So I let it sit in the back of my head for about 2 weeks, and I was white hot with rage, and the rage became this book. I sat down the first day and wrote 13,000 words. So I think that it's ungainly, and it's often really obvious when you try to wrap a story around your politics. But I think if you're writing from an authentic place within yourself, your politics become part of your story. You can't help it.
Yeah, and the thing that I would say is, for me, I work with a lot of consultants. So I can't be in my head wondering, how have I done representing, you know, sex workers who do this kind of sex work? Did I do good? Did I do bad? I wonder, will people like it? Will they not like it? I'll drive myself nuts. So I write what I want to write, and then I engage with people in the community and have them read it. And I'll tell you, a sex worker activist, unfortunately she's passed away since she read the book, may she rest in peace, she eviscerated my plot. She's like, this has got to go, this has got to go, this is a stereotype, this is not okay. And I was like, and because I want to be accountable to the communities that I write about, I was like, oh shit, okay. And I had to change huge parts of my plot. And of course, it's better for having done that. But for me, it's like, I write the book that I want to write, and then think about who are the constituencies that I'm representing in this book that I don't have lived experience of what that's like for them. And then I reach out to people. Some folks call them, some folks are called sensitivity readers. I have activist consultants. Even like, I'm a Black woman, but I had a Black woman from Chicago consult on my second book, because I'm not from Chicago. Chicago, and this stuff takes place in Chicago, and I want to honor the experiences of people. So I write what I want, but then I engage people in the process. I pay them if they need to get paid. I couldn't pay them a lot, but, you know, like, pay them something to honor their time. And then I don't have to be rattling around in my mind wondering, did I get it? Because it's really the feedback from people in the process, not waiting to get hate mail from people telling me, like, you did a crappy job of representing my community.
Do you have?
I mean, I think someone asked me once, someone who didn't like my book, why didn't you just write an essay? but I think, you know, I think there is a bias against political writing that I don't know if you faced it, but there are a lot of people who just don't like political fiction, you know, and that's fine, you know, but I think it's very worthwhile. You know, I think it has to work as a novel. It has to be driven by character and storytelling. So I think the way we're talking about it up here might sound quite clinical, but I really doubt any of us approach the actual writing that way. It's kind of like after the fact, then you can kind of look at it like that. I can say when I started writing this book, I didn't know what fat positivity was, and I didn't know what fat activism was. So I didn't start out with a kind of agenda. The book changed, you know, the book changed my life and the writing of the book. See, I don't want to give the impression that I was sitting down kind of like just turning a nonfiction book into a fictional story. It definitely wasn't like that, the process of it. Because I don't think that would work. I don't think readers would like that.
When you do that, you get Atlas Shrugged.
Yes. Yeah. So we have time for one more short question.
There you go.
Hi.
Thank you. My question is kind of bouncing off of this person's question in the front. What do you do when you're dealing with editors and maybe they aren't aware kind of the people that you're writing about that are marginalized, the culture, people with experiences with, you know, with their bodies and et cetera? How do you deal with that?
Well, I mean, I want to say that I was really prepared when I started shopping this book that I would get people saying, you can't have this much politics and lesbian sex. And I mean, I did hear that from people, but I pretty quickly got hooked up with an editor, with an agent who didn't end up selling the book, but did help me a ton. And, you know, I was sort of bracing myself when she said, I want to talk to you about it. I was sort of bracing myself for that. And she didn't say any of that. Like, all of her critiques had to do with the writing, and I agreed with 90% of them. So I think you can get lucky. And, like, one thing is that I've been impressed with who's out there who is willing to take a book on its terms. Mm-hmm. And I think you just have to be prepared to move on if you don't find those people.
Yeah, I think having the right editor is a big part of that. And if you're with somebody who's just not understanding your politics, you're probably not in the right place. But like you, I was totally ready for the fight. I came with receipts. I showed up with all of my research. I had a whole file. I was like, if they have a problem with X, Y, or Z, I have all of these links. I am ready. And for the most part, I got edited on my writing, and they were right. But factually, I've been very lucky, and I hope that aspiring writers everywhere find the right agent and the right editor, and we don't have stupid fights about who has sex.
And I, you know, I'll say my journey was that I queried over 100 agents to get my agent, and the agent that I got wasn't even one of those 102. She was like the colleague of an agent who's like, this isn't for me, but you might like this. So you have to cast a net far and wide. Then my agent shopped my book all over town, and all the big five and, you know, the cool indies and whatever passed on it, and I ended up at a press that I could have gone to directly, right, that takes unsolicited manuscripts. But it was good for me to know that it wasn't a fit there. And so I think, like, the fight is, as folks have been saying, you've got to believe in your work, and you've got to do your best work. And it's like, if you keep fighting, you put it out there, you get feedback, you put it out there, maybe you get a yes, maybe you get a partial yes, then you work on it. And like, you keep having to make those decisions. They're saying that it needs more this. Do I agree? Do I believe that? And if I do, then I'm going to give it more this and see. Or maybe, I don't know, maybe like the fantasy for me, like, of course we all have the fantasy, and it'll be a bestseller. And even though it's not in a genre that's understood, somehow it will magically, you know, take off and everyone will be, you know, so like, or is my fantasy of what it means to be an author not based in reality? And the truth is, like, I can sell this book and it'll be published, and, you know, it won't change my economic fortunes forever or the face of human history, but it'll be a good book and it'll be out there. So I think that that's part of it too, like being in the process of working on your craft, putting it out in the world, getting information, sifting through that, what do I believe, what's my next step? And you kind of plod forward until you find that moment where you have like the right agent or editor, the right press that is still like open and printing things, you know, and the windows in the literary industry is like some kind of crazy game that's like they're constantly opening and closing. And so you have to be like with the right book in the right place at the right time with the right person who's looking for that right then. So you just have to keep trying.
And on that note, thank you to our wonderful panelists. And thank you, our wonderful audience, for your great questions. Thanks for coming. And we will be signing books right there, right now. So stick around. Thank you.
We hope you enjoyed this podcast from the 2017 Bay Area Book Festival. For more podcasts, please go to www.baybookfest.org.